Could you say your name and spell your name for me?
Yeah. Stephen Nelson, StephenNelson.
And what's your date of birth?
26th of February, 1961.
And can you tell me a bit about where, first of all, where did you live in Leytonstone area in 19... We're looking at the period from 1994 to 1995. When did you, can you remember what
84 to 1995,
is that right? Yes, yeah, 84
to 95.
Can you remember when you, what year you moved in?
Yes, I just left, I just finished being junior fellow in painting at Cheltenham, and I moved there, moved to London in 85. I think I moved in around about winter 87, 1987.
Into
the 127 Dyers Hall Road.
Can you sort of describe your first impressions of that house? Like, when you obviously went down and had a look at it before you accepted it. What was it like?
We were pretty shocked. I was with a partner at the time. And we were sort of second or third generation. It was, I think people were invited in waves. So the hardcore, slightly older artists were invited in... I don't know, 84, and we were picking up, we'd made an application, and we were picking up the kind of, the less conditioned houses. So we were getting the dregs, really. And our one was an absolute fucking nightmare. I just remember looking at it and thinking, God, this is where deadbeats live, or this is the kind of place people squat, if people squatted those days. I think they did. And it had, I mean, you went in through a pile of rubble, and then there was no front door. And then there was some stairs, and there was, when you got into the kitchen, there was a hole straight up through to the roof, so there's no floor there. It was a disaster, absolute disaster. And I just couldn't, and all the windows were boarded up, I just couldn't conceive. Nowadays, it'd be like, you know, a sort of fixer-upper opportunity. And with all those changing room programs, you just go, wow, I can do this and make a profit. Those days, it's just beyond my ken, my belief that I could do anything with it. So it was a real shithole, really was, in a state. Just beyond what we could imagine. So, I mean, what we could imagine living in and what we could imagine actually reconstructing and doing. So it was just a horror when we got offered it. Well, you know, it's like hotel rooms. You had this idea that it would be like, you know, so it's really well maintained or something like that, and we did really get the last of the last, but you know.
But you still accepted it?
Yes, needs must, yeah. No, it's just a great, I mean, I was having studios, I had a studio at Chisnell, I had one at Cable Street, and they're all sublets, and I was and just the chance to have some, and plus Acme at the time, because it was such a state, I think they gave us 2 years rent free. That's how bad a state it was in. So a year rent free in order to do it up. So, it was absolute needs must, and it was so reasonable.
And how long did it take you to kind of renovate it to your needs, really?
We did the living quarters in about 9 or 10 months, with friends chipping in and family helping out here and there. And then the studios were the bare bones. They were absolutely the bare bones. They were just, you know, down to the floorboards. So I think it probably took all told a year.
Okay. The houses in Dyers Hall Road, like how many rooms did you have in there for?
They were, the rooms in Dyers Hall Road were 2 up, 2 down. The classic Victorian house, 2 up, 2 down, bathroom, kitchen. Bathroom above the kitchen, and then, yeah, 2 lower rooms divided by a partition wall, which some people took out. And then my partner Angela and I had 2 studios at the back, upstairs in the house. So it's 2 up, 2 down, Victorian terrace.
And if you can give me a few more details about, like, at what point did you sort of accept the condition and, like, how much you kind of did it up? How did you paint it all white or, you know, what were the decisions?
I mean, the first decisions were basically very rudimentary, like get the door on. And of course, we couldn't live in it for about 3 or 4 months because it was just... So they had a plumber in, whose name I've forgotten, who did all the basic plumbing, because it had no plumbing, all that had been ripped out as well. Somebody had taken all the lead and the copper. So he put in the basic plumbing, and that took about 2 or 3 months. And then we had to, put glass in the windows, put doors on, put a front door on and a back door, build door frames, put the floors in, and plaster the walls. I remember that really in that order specifically. I remember very cold winter, sort of February, plastering walls. Horrible. And so all the really basic things took about between them, I think, about 3 to 6 months before we could move in. And then I think we lined the walls with lining paper. My partner had quite, she had a good sense of interior design. And we made the front room, the living room, and the bedroom pretty habitable. So that was nice, stripping the doors and making that kind of nice. Kitchen was quite rudimentary because there was just nowhere to go. Had a butler sink, oven. I don't even think we had a washing machine. No, I don't think so. I can't remember. And I worked there. It was very small. So I think between 3 and 6 months we'd moved in. And then we just got to this point where we just had enough of doing stuff on it. So I think, you know, by the, about the 9th, 10th month, we just stopped. I'd stopped making work, sort of. And there were people, and I know it exists now, who invest an enormous amount of effort in their houses and it just stopped them practicing. They spent all their time doing that, and then their house got better and better. And I remember realizing, I think, shit, you might only be here for 2 years. Make art, you know, make it comfortable, make art. And so I think it was pretty basic. I think the walls were generally white or off-white or nothing too dramatic, very simple. I remember getting very cheap carpets, like $1.99 a square yard, dreadful things. And the stairs were, again, they weren't carpeted, they were still, but it was something, somehow I quite liked it actually, except for the bathroom. We differentiated two spaces, which is, you know, artistically how you imagine things, you know. I have a live space and I have a workspace. And that's what we did. And we had a dog, so that tended to destroy everything. So all our hard work went to, you know, our nice garden went to shit, and the carpets went to shit, and the door went to shit, because the dog ate everything. So that changed everything. And then, you know, yeah, I think we just got to a point where we just thought, well, there's no point, you know, making this. And Angela, I think, was a bit more... more interested in making it a home, and I was like halfway between, yeah, it's a nice house, but I want a studio. And eventually I just said, right, that's it, no more DIY, enough, I have to make some art. And it just, and it was, I think people came, thought it was a reasonably nice house. But that was relative to some of the less reasonably nice houses. No, it was all learning on the job. I was fortunate in that my next door but one neighbour, I guess it was like when my parents bought their first semi-detached, it was everybody mucking in on a certain level. I think, you know, I think people will look back at those days nostalgically when you talk to your neighbour over the fence and said, do you want a hand? And he had done his own place up, I think 2 years prior to that, and he was, Robin had been a printmaker at Chelsea MA, and I inadvertently met him through a friend, moved in next door one to him, bumped into him on the street, and he'd done all his own building. So literally he would come around and just say, here's what you do. Mix the plaster like this, put the lath in, put the primer down and, you know, seal it and all this kind of stuff. And he'd gone with it, bought a float. So it was trips, and Travis Perkins was, I think, about 300 metres away.
So they were all Acme?
They were all Acme people. And he'd got his, he had one kid then. And he'd done everything himself. So strangely enough, he got into that world, the building world. He'd gone into some of that, as well as printmaking. So he just said, you know, here's what you need to do with the joists. You take them out. And then you do find that most of it's pretty rudimentary. You know, once you know, it isn't all that complex. So plastering, yeah, it wasn't the best job in the world, but and we got better. I mean, putting windows in, that was kind of a pain in the bottom. It was, you know, putty and all that kind of stuff. But enjoyable, really, I guess, you know, learning.
So you mentioned about the ceilings, like some of the ceilings you put back and others.
Oh, we just, yeah, it was just one of those things where there were so many things to do, and we'd, where the joists were on the ceiling in the bathroom, they were bare for ages, and I just got to the point, like, having a very, very heavy meal where I just was satiated, completely full up with plasterboard and dust. And I remember cutting two bits of plasterboard and just whacking the bloody things up and just saying, right, and that's it. As long as there's no dust falling on the food. And then several months later, I remember cooking and looking up and thinking, I must get round to that as these galvanized, but I never did. That was it. It was just, it really was full up.
With. It was like 9 months full on.
Sort of, yeah. It took over, yeah. But you know what it's like. It's like most people, if they have the builders in, as they call it now, having the builders in, you can't put your stereo on because there's dust everywhere. You can't. It's just dust everywhere. It's in your, you know, getting up in the morning without central heating, you know, before the gas was installed, and sleeping in your clothes and all that kind of strange stuff, which, you know, I don't really want to do again. I probably will one more time. But, It was quite... I mean, you know, in hindsight, it was a learning experience. But at times, it was horrible. You know, it's horrible. I mean, you know, as I say, maybe 3 to 6 months to make it habitable. And then when we got in, there was still tons of work to do. But, like, pathetic little stuff, like lining the walls, putting the ceilings in, plastering bits and bobs. Then it was like, you know, home decor after the serious building work. I think some of the wiring, the plumbing was done by Acme, and the rest was us. And we were, you know, I mean, we were like 25, we're like, great, rent free, let's get it done quicker. And I had a colleague, friend from down the street, and he did it was amazing, he did every single door with such precision. And his house was like a home, it really was a home. And in that period, they just, the couple who went there, they just stopped making work. Strange, but the house was beautiful, exquisite stripped floorboards. And so I'm sort of glad I called a halt to it at some point.
So you moved into your Acme house in 1987.
I think round about then, yeah.
Can you remember what year you moved out?
I moved out in 1990.
Okay. And you've spoken about all the extensive work you did on your house.
Yeah.
Can you describe a little bit about, you know, the street, Dyers Hall Road, and the rest of the community, and, like, roughly how many artists lived down there and so forth?
It was... I think we were 127. We were number 127 Dyers Hall Road. So I suppose that it's had a strange configuration, slightly L-shaped, like an inverted L, back front L, curved to the bottom. We were on the cusp of the curve at the bottom of the road, which linked to Canal Road. Canal Road? What was the road? What did you live on?
I was on Colford Road. So
Colford Road. You're off. What was that?
Grove Green Road.
That's right. So we were on the edge of where it touched Grove Green Road, and it kind of an inverted L or a J, and it went up, and I think all of our row, so we were like 122, 131 was the end of the row. There must have been about 70 houses along there, semi-detached Victorian terraced, and all the 70 on my row, give or take one or two, were occupied by artists, I presume Acme. Couple of squatters. We had squatters next to us, sort of posh bikers. The opposite side of the road was proper people, and I think they were staying. I think they literally survived the Link Road, and they knew that. And then there was a school whose name I can't remember. And the other side of the road had another block of maybe 12, 13 houses, and they were Acme houses as well. And there was a road came up. So it's sort of, I would guess, about 70, 80 houses. pretty standard Victorian street. I remember privet bushes being the sort of obstruction to the artist's house, and I'm sure they liked that, actually. I'm sure they did. And I remember the whole street, people, like clever artists who put up things like tissue paper. But a lot of people had their studios downstairs. It was interesting, we chose upstairs. They put up those sort of like, in fact, like the tissue paper I've got on my studio now, this sort of transparent stuff that lets light in but obstructs people from seeing you. That and the privets, because I just remember walking on and wanting to nose into everybody's studio. But I think, yeah, privets. Privets and very low walls, very low Victorian walls with privet bushes there. And of course, unkept. You know, there were, I don't think there was about probably two people interested in their front garden and the whole street. So very, very unkept and not many cars. Yeah, not many cars, actually, when I think about it. It should have been, if it had been in Clapham or somewhere like that, or Wandsworth, it would have been full of cars. Of course, economically, nobody could afford cars. So it's just as you came out of the house, you walk straight up the street with the odd car. Very different now. I mean, how it would have been, I think, or a street now. Other than that, nothing very striking. A sort of footbridge that took you across the railway just round the corner from my house to sort of the old Leytonstone Football Club and Travis Perkins and the railway arches. I think it took you to Leytonstone High Road eventually. Yeah, not a very, not a particularly distinctive street, just a classic.
And what about the people you socialised with in the area? On your street, I mean, did you know your artist neighbours?
Yeah, sort of. Inadvertently, the way it all worked for me was that I'd met the people who were on my street prior to coming to the street, as it were. And for instance, Robin, who was next door at one, I'd met him at Chelsea when I was doing my MA at Birmingham, and then ended up bumping into him when I moved in. Somebody, word of mouth, saying he lived there. And then down the street was another artist called Mark Thomas, who I'd met when he came to Birmingham to teach, when I was doing my MA, and he lived there. And then Georgina, who lived next door, was, again, we obviously met day to day, how are you, neighbours and all that. But she was another friend of a friend. So yeah, my next door neighbour. And then after that, hardly anybody. I didn't know hardly anybody, and it was very strange. I think it's probably partly, it's a little bit of my failing, but I kind of hate the social groups I belong to. I hated students when I was a student. I hated myself for being a student, and I sort of hate myself for being an artist, and I felt I was terribly grown up. I think I did, maybe I was slightly, I just thought I was quite grown up. I wasn't particularly, but I just didn't, I still don't like it that much, you know, artists sort of hanging out together with artists. It's my idea of hell, moaning and talking about shows. And I don't mind it on a small level, but it just didn't happen. Socially, I went to the North Coast a couple of times, but I didn't even like it around here when it all happened, kind of Hoxton, Hackney. Even the YBA thing, I hate it. I hate, you know, all those. There should have been more anthropologists down there or something. Acme should have like mixed and matched, maybe a few dancers, something interesting, pop stars, anything but artists. So I didn't really, I guess I knew about four or five people on the whole street, and then a couple of people around the corner on Grove Green Road, like yourself, but only because of working through the Whitechapel Art Gallery did I come into contact with artists who lived in my community, and then got to know them that way around rather than bumping into them. So I didn't know many people, actually. I was just snooty, that's about it. Just really snooty.
That kind of takes us on to the next question, which is, your work at the time. Because you've mentioned the Whitechapel, I mean, perhaps we should start with the Whitechapel and like what you did there and how you got involved.
Yeah, sure. Are you thinking of work as in earning money, or work as in the creative process? Both.
I suppose everything, but I suppose what would be a really good way to start would be like, because you had a lot of workshop involvements, didn't you, in Whitechapel, and you worked a lot with Jenny Lomax, and
yeah,
a key person there.
Yeah.
I think it'd be really good to sort of start from that point and then talk about your own practice. But I was just wondering how that came about initially.
I remember having a... I don't know how this worked. I remember having a push bike and going somewhere in the East End. I remember now. I went to Atlantis when it was in Wapping to buy some paper from Leytonstone on a push bike. Seems like a long way. And on the way past, I thought, hey, it's the famous Whitechapel Art Gallery, where I'd been to see shows and stuff. I should pop in and see if there's any jobs. It was pretty naive. And I got there, and the gallery was closed. They were literally rebuilding it. I didn't know this. It was like 1987. And they were all in the library next door. And in the way that you do when you're quite young, I knocked on the door, and I went in, and all these people were standing there looking at me, very sophisticated. And I said, is Jenny Lomax here? The education department. I'm interested in doing education work. And people were okay. And I remember being greeted by this guy, and he said, well, she's not here at the moment, but what are you doing next week? And I said, I'll be in the studio. Nothing really, I'll be in the studio. He said, do you want some work? And I went, what? And he said, we're just moving some stuff from one place to another, basically shifting. He said, do you want to do it? Starts next week, a week's work. And I went, yeah, great, because I had no work. And I thought, great, I can come off the dole and do a week's work. Went down there, and it was that, moving catalogues and rubbish around. 1 week turned into two turned into three. Eventually, I met Jenny Lomax in a kind of informal context. I just sort of said, oh, and the guy said, oh, this is Jenny. Da, da, da. And then a job came up, strange, and a job came up in the education department, which was, I think, it was called part-time schools coordinator. And it was 3 days a week. And the proviso was that you had to be an artist. Ideally, you had to understand the area, or live in the area, or know the area, and I was in Leytonstone, of course. And I had no experience, really, in education. I taught I taught when I was doing my MA at Birmingham Poly. I taught hairdressers. It was great fun. And the job came up, and I applied for it formally, and I got an interview, and I was down to the last three or four. And I remember working with Jocelyn Clark and Kathy McCarthy, who were already working there, like really sophisticated, sexy ladies and fabulous. And I did my interview with them, and I remember I was absolute rubbish. But they told me in hindsight when I got the job, I remember Nick Sirota ringing me up, and he just sounded really nervous. It's very funny. Well, I realised now he does. That's what he sounds like. I got offered the job, and they said it was primarily, I shan't say who I was up against for the job, but they said it was primarily because I washed the paintbrushes. I did everything else like everybody else, but they said that after the session, I was one of the few people who stayed behind to clean up and chat. And they thought this was a good sign that I could, because they said two people, especially the blokes, that's really weird. Basically, I just walked away and left everything. And so I got the job, and it was, I think it was 3 days a week, and it was schools coordinator, which basically was liaison as an artist with the artists who come to work at the Whitechapel with primary and secondary school groups. So it was working with Jenny Lomax, and I was sort of responsible for all the coordination of what happened inside the gallery. I was dreadful at it. But I would meet with the artists, and we'd collaborate, and we'd work on the workshops, and we'd devise programs, and I'd be the linchpin, basically. So when artists came, I would be the one focal point for the schools, and artists would come in and input and get involved. So I did that for about 4 years, which is brilliant, because that actually brought me into contact with people like yourself and people who worked in the community who I didn't know. So people like Jeff Dennis and Joss Clark and some other people. Actually, maybe a few others. Gary Stevens. He lived there, I think, then. And a few other people. And Gary Stevens did live there then, I think. Yeah, he did. And a few other people around there. But it brought me into contact with the artist community en masse, like a lot of young artists, plus the private views. And it was a great time, really good time.
So can you remember, what year you started at Whitechapel Art Gallery?
Yeah, I think I got the job. I think again, I'll have to look into it. I think I got the job in 1987. So it was sort of after about a year and a half in London. I'd been on the dole. I'd been carrying boxes. I'd worked in a bacon factory. I'd done bits and bobs. I had this dream. I wanted to be a postman, but that was just stupid. And so I'd done all these odd jobs, and that was my first proper job. And it was perfect on one level because I had only 3 days. The rest I could work in the studio. So 87 to I think 1990-91, and I was offered a residency in Hanover, Germany, and it was 6 weeks, and it, plus it coincided with a new Nicholas Rosa leaving and a new director coming, and she was great, but I didn't like the shows that were forthcoming, just not my cup of tea, I think, and I sort of resigned. The two went hand in hand. I wanted to do this residency because I thought it'd be good for me, and it's fun, and I thought it'd be good for my career. And I just, you know, change of everything, and then Jenny left. Yeah, to go to Camden. I just, you know, and I worked with the new director, the new educational director, or what do they call it, the new education person. And she was lovely too, but it was just the shift and emphasis had gone, and you know, all the energy I'd, and the things I believed in. You know, I worked with Nick Serota on shows like Cy Twombly and Bruce Nauman and Richard Deacon and Miro and Gorky. I mean, all the artists I'm fond of, and the artists that were coming, like Yeats and Freud, and just didn't rock my boat really. And so the two went hand in hand. They're just good time. And I was sort of, you know, I was getting a bit stale as well.
It's. I've actually worked at Art Gallery with a key kind of linchpin for artists. I don't know how easy it is to get work now, because that was quite an amazing story, really, that you just popped in. And quite quickly kind of progressed.
Yeah, I think it's feasible now. I think that. I mean, this is the other thing as well. I didn't like the new structures of how things are done. I mean, that was a very formal process. Jenny had seen me and met me and thought I was amenable, and she'd seen my work because I was in one of the Whitechapel Opens. That was a kind of proviso as well. A lot of the artists were chosen from their work in the Whitechapel Open. So I remember that was the sort of talent scouting. And so when we had the Whitechapel Open, Jenny would ask that certain artists, would they be interested in coming to do a trial workshop? Because their work might have some relevance to the community, or the work interesting, or they sounded interesting. And so we did, that was our talent scouting at the Whitechapel Open. And that doesn't exist anymore. And I think all those opportunities have almost gone. And now, generally, you have to send. The Whitechapel actually introduced this, even when I left, and I thought it's so wrong, the wrong way to go about it. Artists had to send slides on to be archived, and a covering letter, and they would go on their database, and I just thought, that's fucking rubbish. It's, how do you know what they're, you know, I mean, what a waste of energy. Just invite them in, you know, or communicate with them, or go to their studios, or see their work in a show, and look at, and meet them, and just say, would you be interested? It's so much more amenable, and I mean, more sympathetic, easier to do. So nowadays, I mean, even at somewhere like I ended up then working some of the time for Tate Britain after Whitechapel, because somebody had heard about me, a woman who was trying to start the education department at Tate with sort of younger people, and it had been a lot of volunteers, older people, often retired, running the Tate, which was then the Tate Gallery, education. She wanted a more kind of funky, younger person, artist-led, lots of workshops, more practical things. And she invited me and two or three other artists in to do stuff there. Why am I telling you this? Because she literally, through word of mouth, invited me to talk and invited me to have a go. And I got into the Tate Gallery that way, doing sort of lectures for kids and little workshops and stuff like that. But when Tate Modern opened, and this is a sign of the times, everybody who worked at Tate Modern through the new director of education there was invited to apply for a job, and the job involved a contract of 2 days a week, so you had to be there for 2 days a week, and the duties that one could perform in that time were destined to be decided, well, were decided by the Tate Education Department, and they wanted you to attend lectures given by curators and education staff, 10 lectures over 3 months, and the lectures were on things like Bruce Nauman, and I just thought, fuck off, I'm not having somebody telling me, you know, somebody who's, but I mean, it was just extraordinary way to treat people. And I think that's all changed, you're right. I think in those, I mean, it sounds dreadful, doesn't it? It was kind of naive and but fun and sort of communicative, you know? And people met and socialised and talked and, as I say, at some level, Leytonstone had that. And I think that's gone, I think, you know. And we all met at Whitechapel Opening.
Because the work you did at the Tate, what time was that?
That would have been about 92, 91, 92. After the Whitechapel, yeah. I came back from Germany, and still, and you know, I needed work like everybody else. And luckily, that coincided with that. And then Jenny had gone to Camden, and so, but I basically became a freelancer as opposed to having a contract, which suited me for a while.
Going back to the Whitechapel Open again, because that was pretty amazing, because you brought your actual work there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
I can remember the scene of like all these artists coming down from Brick Lane, just holding their work.
Yeah, definitely. And Leytonstone and the like, and sharing cars and saying, are you dropping stuff off? It was done so haphazardly, but physically, I think it's vitally important to do this thing. I just get a feeling now that nobody wants a fucking artist in the gallery. They want to have them, fuck you, and put the slides in a box and. And that was, I think, in a way, although it sounds a bit pretentious, but I think they were involving artists in the process of actually coming into the gallery. So that's really strange. Dropping your work off, communicating, signing a chitty of paper, handing your work over, handing it to somebody from the gallery. They put it in a pile. You see where it goes. You're actually, you know, involved in the process of visiting the gallery. And there wasn't, you know, people moaned a bit about the Whitechapel, you know, particularly if you didn't get in. But it provided so many opportunities. They don't need those opportunities now, but I think the commitment, the Whitechapel's commitment to that community and that whole generation of artists, which still exist, you know, we're in the East End now, it's appalling how they've... We all met through that. We communicated through that. We didn't communicate through white clear buildings. It was a public space that, you know, strangely, I got to... Oh, people who worked on the gallery staff at the Whitechapel lived in Leytonstone. Remember Ian Edwards, I think Phil Medley lived there. We communicated through that, the Whitechapel as a conduit for all the artists somehow in the East End, whether they were working in education, whether they were gallery technicians, whether they came to openings. The openings were just full of artists and, hey, have you met such and such? And, oh, you live in Leytonstone, wow, amazing. Oh, you're in the open, oh, brilliant. And people come to the opening and... Several friends of mine and myself, I sold my first piece of work from the open. Fantastic commitment to the community is completely gone. They literally expunged it from the. It just went somehow. It was a fixture on our landscape, and it was a fixture for most people. Most people, it was our Royal Academy, it was our summer show. You know, you had a 1 in 8 chance of getting in, or 1 in 10, or whatever it is. Hard work. If you did get on, it was, you know, you could. It was quite a moment when you got in. I mean, people being very proud about it. It was, you know, and it was an international gallery. You weren't showing in, you know, and they didn't treat you like a piece of shit, which I think is what they do now. I mean,
because actually, I remember Jenny, you know, was really amazing actually, because the outreach program.
Oh, yeah.
Was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then. Straight after Jenny, curates that come to doing those international shows, and just kind of, I don't know, the sort of professional level of thinking, I think, is actually really high.
Yeah, I think so.
Actually.
Well, I think it's interesting at Camden, because I think the only thing Jenny suffers from at Camden, because what she's doing is curating some of the best shows in London. It's one of the few places you generally know you'll see something interesting. Yeah, of course, many of them are international artists. But the mix and match thing is good. Younger artists, slightly older. The programs, the educational space that's ongoing. The only thing she suffers from, she doesn't have an artistic community. There isn't one there. She's just in the wrong place. Whereas with the Whitechapel, they utilise that. And I think both the education department and the exhibition department understood that that was the community with in which they were based. International Art Gallery just happened to be in the East End, or, you know, which was the remit of the gallery, education for the people, the poorer people of the East End. And I think Jenny always understood that. And when she went, that changed. And I think it's not entirely true that the whole notion of grassroots education changed completely. And I think it suffered from that. And I would really, I mean, it's not really from Nick Sirota, but I would say that Jenny leaving the Whitechapel was as big a blow to its role in the community as, I mean, I went there, I think I mentioned in that book, that I went there the last time about 3 years ago, and they had a separate room for like members, and it was really strange, and there were very glamorous people there, and I hardly knew anybody. It was bizarre. I didn't even recognize anybody, and everybody was behaving like, isn't art the most fantastic thing? And we didn't have that. It was really making do and getting by. I mean, I think we were all involved in something, whether it was hanging paintings or transporting art and making art. And I think that the Whitechapel had, you know, they absolutely knew where Grove Green Road was. And now they, you know, and I think they couldn't ignore the whole thing, you know. So many artists either went through the, you know, the doors of the Whitechapel in one way or another.
Because even there, I remember if you were strapped to the couch, you'd go down and ask if there were any jobs on the mail. So it was like every single level.
That's right, yeah.
Tell me a bit about the work that you actually got into the open exhibitions.
I got three pieces in, and I think for some reason, I don't know why, Jenny liked my work, I think, and that was the other thing as well, which was sort of interesting. It was always, I think, which I think is very important as well, which they do less of now. Jenny and Nick Sirota, plus one other, were always the selectors. So they had a guest curator. But the idea that, you know, those two people, plus, you know, Nick Sirota, who, you know, has a great eye, would choose you for an exhibition, seems so much better than franchising it out to three random people who didn't understand. So I think the exhibition was chosen on so many different levels. I think contextually now, it would be really fascinating to look at how that exhibition was chosen, because it really did. I mean, I know this sounds terribly now. It really did have a huge slice of the community in the exhibition. Well, you had to come from the East End, so it had to be in the postcode, but that didn't mean that you couldn't come from SE11 or conversely SE1. But he and Jenny were just fantastic, involving, you know, artists like that, as different as Shafiku Dean and Anthony Gormley and Zarina Bimji, and people who represented the community on one level, plus, you know, Richard Deacon and all these people who passed through the Whitechapel Open. And then also artistically representing what was going on. Seriously, representing. So you'd have your work next to, I think my first show was next to Cathy DeMoncho. And Charles Satchi bought her piece, and that was it for Cathy. So she just went, shoo. And not me, could it be me? And it was a fantastic piece she made. It was really good. Everybody focused on it. But in that show, there were like figurative painters of painting, like photorealist paintings, people painting dogs. There was always like something quirky in there. Like there was always a sort of, and humour, and it was an incredibly well curated show. It really did reflect what was going on. And inadvertently, that became a kind of internationalism with people like Deacon and Gormley, and Cathy. And, I got into that, and then I got into, and then I started working there. I never showed. I think it was, I did bribe. There were bribes involved. And I got into two others, and I think the third one.
What do you mean?
I bribed staff members like Jenny Lomax and Nicholas Rosa. You can tell them. In fact, if it comes out, he'll lose that tenure at the Tate. This law, cash for art, honours questions, things. It'll be brought up at Prime Minister's question time.
You probably thought you bribed them.
I think I bribed them. I made them coffee and things like that. It's like a bribe, isn't it? I grovelled. That's what I did. I grovelled to be in the show. And my third time I got in it, I can't remember, maybe I was in it four times, I can't remember, I'm so blasé, and it was a big deal, it was such a big deal, but I think it was a big deal because you want things to happen and things to be sold, and eventually, in my third or fourth one, I had a piece of work bought, and it was quite a good piece of work, I liked it, and the piece the year before had been called Pretentious Conceptual Object Making. That's what I was in one shot, in a review. But it got reviewed as well, you know, so everyone had to review it because it was the most happening show. And then a very famous collector, or a big collector, bought my piece of work in the fourth show, and I thought, this is great. And then he invited me for dinner, and I said no because I was cooking for some other people, which is like a big sort of artistic faux pas. And I don't think he's spoken to me since. And I should have went, and it'd have been, you know, but it sold to this really, because people came and they, you know, serious collectors came to the White Chapel.
So where did that piece end up?
It ended up with a gentleman called Peter Fleissig, who has a museum which is movable. I think, I've been told this since. So his art collection is lent out, given and shifted and moves around the world. He lends them to people if they want them, if they like them, and stuff like that. So it's in kind of big, could be in a skip by now, but I don't really know. But he liked it. It was a rubber piece that was kind of sexy and threatening, and he liked it. I was shocked, you know. I just couldn't believe that anybody could buy it. And it's, I mean, my work, you know, wasn't what one would call immediately sellable now. It was two car shock absorbers that sat side by side on the wall, and one was, I'd split the top of them and I put the sort of like a rubber flange in the top that was vulva-like. I mean, not really, but it was turned in on itself, so it had a kind of butterfly, and they were about, I guess they're about 10 inches, 11 inches tall, and the top, I inserted this sort of flanged. Imagine a cupcake wrapper turned in on itself and then slotted in the top, but rubber. I don't know where I'd found this. I think it was from a motorbike. And the other piece was exactly the same shock absorber, but the top had been opened. And I'd carved a piece of rubber, which was like a lip, that came out like a sort of flaccid penis. And so, and they just were attached to the wall. No, this was a later piece, and it's all about positioning. It was in a really good site, probably in the same. They seem to put all the smaller works on the top floor. It's quite small, and that was sited in a good position. I remember somebody telling me, it was bizarre, some veteran of the Open or something, said, you know, it's about where they put your work, where it's going to be seen, where you are and stuff. And in the first one, I was next to Cathy. I didn't have a chance of anything. I mean, you just couldn't see my work. Cathy's work was so extraordinary. Mine was this dodgy old box with a bit of leather next door to it. And hers was just this exquisitely, beautifully crafted, sexy, violent, you know, what the thing that people came to know.
Long
tube with velvet. Yeah, exactly.
So give me a bit more of a description of your
hair. Oh, it was hideous. It wasn't hideous. It was a piece of leather that was from the corner, by which time I'd moved from Dyers Hall Road. It was literally on the cusp of, I remember, no, I still lived at Dyers Hall Road, that was it. I decided I should get a studio, because my room at Dyers Hall Road was getting too small, and I decided I should get a studio, and I got a student angel. And in there, they'd left these boxes with leather corners to protect the basketware. And I'd taken these leather bits off, and they were almost like cod pieces. And on there, I'd painted a sort of shroud from a Mantegna painting. And that was it. It was just leather with little holes in the corner, the size of a sort of big sort of cricket box, like a, I don't know what you call that, like a penis protector or something. Yeah. about the size, just a bit bigger than the hand. And on it in black ink, I'd painted this shroud, which was Christ's cloth from. And I placed it in this found pink box, like a box. I should have just hung the leather. I just didn't. I boxed it. I don't know why I drew into box. But it was so much slower than my piece. Kathy's had everything. It was, you know, it was just, it had everything. It was just one of those real signature pieces. Mine was just this little, it was like the ugly kid, you know, with the beautiful, you know, friend.
Was that the 1990 show?
I would say that was about 1990, yeah. I think three or four. I think
1990 as well.
I think it was 89. I think 89 or 90 was my first one. I can't remember, but that was my first one. I think that was my first one, and I just literally got the job there. Or had I? 87. No, I must have been there about 2 years. Yeah, I told you I bribed somebody. No, I was there 2 years. I think what happened was, in my case, is, and I think which happens with a lot of these things, is when people are judging things, if they know your work, you have a greater chance. I think it is. If they know your work, I don't know whether that works on a conscious level or a subliminal level, it's just as it comes passing through. If they know you or maybe know your work, sometimes it works against you and sometimes it works blind, you know, but on not... always, but I do know of a story which was told to me, and I don't know how apocryphal or true this is, that in the Royal Academy several years ago, actually no, it was when I was 8, but about this time, mid-80s, a lot of the Royal Academicians were elder and getting on, and they go out for these lovely long lunches and come back, and paintings that the guys who were taking the paintings through, they'd walk through with the paintings, and the gentlemen, they were usually gentlemen, would say, that one. No, that one. And as they were passing through like a parade. And when they'd been out for lunch, this guy told me, because he was one of these people, they put the paintings around the back and bring them back through again. And because they were of a certain age and had a few drinks, they wouldn't remember. But what would happen is by the second or third time they bring them through, they go, it seems familiar. That one. So if you took them through several hours later or a couple of hours later, there's a kind of recognition. I thought that's probably quite true, really. Yes, I mean, they see the context and they may think this is a good or bad piece. And also, you know, I don't even know if my work was in that show because I worked at the Whitechapel. I mean, that's almost an interesting enough reason to be in a Whitechapel open, because I worked there. I'm part of the staff, you know. I mean, I don't know that. It can be, it can work the other way around as well, of course. But I think, I think the first one would have been about, maybe that was the second one then. I can't remember. No, I was in three, I think. I remember three pieces distinctly, but that's terrible. I think I was in three, and it was, but it was on the pieces I was making. The first piece was very Leytonstone, in hindsight. And the works I was making in Leytonstone, they weren't fully formed. It was somewhere between I was taking objects and putting one or two of them together. But I found that the live work space doesn't work for me. And I found that on Leytonstone. I would do really terrible things, like I'd be in the studio and I'd work for a bit and then I'd go and hoover up. Or I'd work for a bit and then I'd go and do something else. Which now, looking back, I do that here. Sort of, I'll go and have a chat with somebody or I'll have a cigarette or something, I don't know, and I'll do that here, but in a different way. Well, I'm trapped here, I'm forcibly made to come here, and I close the door. Whereas in the house, there were so many things, I'd take the dog for a walk, and I found that it didn't work for me. That's why I got another space at Angel. But I was basically taking found objects from both found in the locale and things I'd pick up on my travels, and putting them together. And the only show I think I had in that period, from about 87 to 90, and I had a couple of shows, but the main one was in France in an exhibition called Mind the Gap, just prior to the being in the Whitechapel Almond. So it was really, you know, took a while to get, you know, both building the house and then finally getting back in the studio. And even like somewhere like here where I am now, I've been in here nearly 2 years now, and I'm really just getting going. It's now starting to fill up, and it feels like, you know, things are in place. So I think in the aftermath of building the bloody place and doing all that and then going to the studio, it probably took me about a year and a half to get going, by which time I felt I this wasn't working for me, this live workspace thing. I still worked there, and I went there in the evening and sat there with the work and stuff like that, but I needed more space, and I also needed contact. And I'd already, I think I'd just about moved to Angel or got a studio at Angel prior to the Whitechapel thing, and the Whitechapel provided contact, which I didn't have in the community because I was a miserable gay. I just didn't go out, you know, I didn't have enough friends to go to the pub. That's terrible. Robin, we did go, you know, Angela and I would go sometimes, but Robin didn't drink much and he had two kids. And I just didn't have a clique. I didn't have enough group of friends.
I think that's quite a common reaction in a sense, because that kind of idea of structure and socialising, whereas if you kind of get up, leave your house, go to the studio, it has a whole different feeling about it. I mean, you said that you would, you know, stop in the studio and Hoover up or go chat to someone. You do the same thing, but somehow that going to a separate space.
Yeah.
Can you say a bit more about your work at the time? Because you've said how it influenced by the environment and finding things from the locale.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that process?
Yeah, I mean, I became, I think I was, when I did my degree, I was a painter, and in my final year I moved to sculpture, which didn't go down very well. I started to make three-dimensional objects, welding and things. When I came to London, well, then I went to Cheltenham as a painting fellow. I made some more paintings, but often incorporating objects, like doors and things like that. And when I got to Leytonstone, it's really strange. It was almost like an Arte Povera idea, the texture of poverty was so redolent in that place. And I didn't know it at the time, but obviously Leytonstone was much poorer on one level than it is now. And we were in the shithole. We were in the blighted area to some extent where nobody wanted. And so the area was full of, you know, I mean, I was doing things with, I don't know why, there just seemed to be more rubbish about, skips full of strange things. And I would go down to the river and find things on the canal, a place like that. And I would pick up, I still do it, inveterately picking things up off the street and hubcaps and all that kind of stuff. And then that mixed with the fact that also I'd been involved in DIY for so long, or building and stuff. So I was bringing elements of building and using things like putty and plaster and stuff like that. So and I was combining one or two things together, which I'd always done. So I just wonder if, and plus the studio was really Spartan. It was just, you know, bare Victorian walls, wooden. And I wonder if that whole texture thing, in hindsight, they weren't very good works. I just wasn't. It would have taken me a lot longer to be there, by which time I left. I think I'd have needed to have been there 5 years and focused. And the people for me who I thought were successful were the kind of people who just had little paintings, or who were just pottering away, you know, just had that rectangle in front of them and could focus. I was tied up in there.
What artist comes to mind? You know,
I was thinking of Jeff Dennis, actually. I remember going to Jeff's studio and I think being really, really, really bowled over by, well, the work on one level, but also how well it was, how cosy he'd made it. Had like his cassette, and he had Radio 3 on, and listened to music. And the walls were covered in notations, and he had his little canvases. And I thought it was a kind of cosy practice. Not, I don't mean that in a derogatory term. I think he'd got it sussed. And I need a bigger space. I just know I need a bigger space. I don't know if it's not, you know, I mean, these works aren't getting any bigger because the space is bigger. But I needed a bit more space, and the works were getting inverted, and I wasn't concentrating enough.
Is this something to do with domesticity? Because, like, Jeff Dennis's work, maybe you needed a more industrial space, because what you're explaining about doing up the house is almost preparing a blank canvas.
Yeah.
In which to, is that kind of like, do you think, a sculptural?
Yeah, in retrospect, yeah. I think I spent so much energy on the thing itself. It became, I mean, I stopped it, but it became a piece of work on one level. I mean, that's slightly lofty, but yeah, I think you're right. I think I would have, yeah, I think I just envisaged a, because remember, I'd also gone through the whole system, and I didn't really have a good practice. I'd literally gone from BA to MA to a fellowship, and all along, well, along been given these spaces, you know, which were white cubes, boxes. And when I was in Stroud in the fellowship, this fantastic library with, and I got to London, and then I rented a little space in Cable Street, a little place in Chisenhale, and they were kind of half-hearted, shared things, not really mine, like rented accommodation. And when I got mine, it wasn't quite, I just wasn't, I don't know, it didn't seem right. I didn't have storage. It's all the things you do to make your practice better. I didn't have a plan chest, didn't have storage. I didn't realize that, you know, whereas Jeff, who'd been there several years and was a little bit older than me, he'd got it all set up, you know. He'd got his paint was out. And I would sort of go up there in the morning and go, oh, fuck, I'm still in the house. But, and I'd make some work and I'd come back. And I actually, strangely enough, for the first time in my life, I think I worked late at night. I worked later, which was a good thing about working in the house. You can wander into the studio before you go to bed or for an hour at night and just sit there and think a lot. But it sort of didn't, it didn't work for me particularly.
I mean, I think what kind of did work for you, and I think maybe you're being a bit sort of self-effacive about your practice, I'm sure other people wouldn't think all those things, because in many ways you look very successful, you know, by getting all those pieces in the Whitechapel and also your practice there, because you're working on a very particular level, which I think is really unusual now, because with the workshops, you had such incredible skill with children. I mean, I was sort of really blown away by that because I hadn't seen it before. There was no separation between sort of now it's you go and do workshops in schools, the school teacher is the one who does the crowd control, the rest of it.
Yeah.
And like here was this artist, you, doing the whole lot, you know, crowd control. Yeah. Had a natural skill with the kids, you made them laugh, you could get the work done, and you'd integrate the guest artists working into that process, which actually is very unique.
I found that, I'm just going to cigarette. I found that,